You are listening to the News Project Podcast for the week of August 10th, 2020. Brought to you by GNAT TV, this podcast brings you these stories. Windhall faces a flood of students. Composting can be fun. And the primaries went smooth as butter.
You know, we were looking at an increase of approximately 50 students. I sent you an updated list as of today, which is looking at 37 that came in this afternoon. As you know, it's a very much a moving target. So on any given day, you can, the numbers change. So I'm putting out there for our discussion. You can see that I made a couple of recommendations here that are a starting point because we may want to do something different or consider any of these in isolation or in combination. So there's four areas that I'd like you to consider, and I'll run through all four of them, and then we can open up for discussion. So the first would be that we request that the legislator waive the penalty for the provision of the FY22 and FY23 budgets for all non-operating school districts. So the idea is that at this point, given what's happening in FY21, really one of the key things you're going to need as a non-operating school district is some legislative intervention here. And because the legislature is going back into session later this month, you have an opportunity you don't typically have. So the first one is to waive the penalty provision, which would certainly help. The second recommendation is that you request that the legislature make a statutory change by which the homestead tax rate reaches the non-homestead tax rate, both rates increase in unison to support the budget. Okay, and right now, currently, the non-homestead tax rate is held. It's held stable independent of what happens. And so the consideration to think about is if anybody owns property in a non-operating district, does it make sense to think about the fact that we know that, we understand that there's value, people move to the community of Windhall for specific reasons, and that all taxpayers in the community share the responsibility of students who move in, families that move in with children attending our schools or regional schools. The third thought to consider is requesting that the legislature set a tax rate maximum for non-operating school districts based on a percentage cap over the established budget. So the idea here is a cap. The number two option, it kind of insulates any non-operating school district within its community and doesn't impact any other local communities or other budgets in any other parts of the state. This one would. It would essentially be saying we're going to establish a cap, and once you reach that cap, there'll be some sort of a legislative response, and maybe the ed fund would cover the cost. I'm not sure. That would probably be left to the legislatures, but the idea that you couldn't go over a certain percentage increase. And the fourth consideration is reconsidering the definition of a resident as it relates to a homeowner owning multiple homes when taxpayers are employed out of state or when one parent lives and works outside of the state. So we've got, later on you'll see we put the definition of residency in the packet, a resident in the packet, but do they start to tackle that and look at that differently as far as who actually is a resident of Vermont? So those are four starting points, I think I can turn it over to the board for discussion and further discussion on this topic and see if there's any action that you decide you want to take.
And I would actually like to add at least one option for us to discuss, which I can do now. Actually, why don't I go ahead and do it now, and then maybe we can sort of talk about everything together. I'm not sure if Windhall really fits into the parameters of the COVID relief that has been given to the state of Vermont by the federal government. But when you look at the numbers of families that we have moving to Windhall, and specifically the number of out-of-state families that are moving to Win Hall. I think we have a pretty clear chain of causation that a lot of these families are moving here in response to the pandemic. And I think, you know, this is definitely unprecedented. We've never, ever, ever experienced growth on this level at all. And I think, you know, if there's a way that we could tap into some of those COVID funds, that would be an avenue to explore as well, because this is clearly, in my mind, related to the pandemic. And I think it's a special circumstance that, you know, if there's funding that would be available for that, that might be a good option to explore.
I think we should send any and all of what we just talked about. I mean, we've been talking for years about how we don't fit the funding formula, and right. You know, we've sort of just struggled on and tried to meet that challenge the best we can. But we're in a situation now where it's never going to be more obvious how broken the funding formula is than right now.
Right.
So I think that we really need to push the legislature to do something, because we're never going to get a better opportunity than this to prove our point, which is that the funding formula makes almost no sense for a town like Win Hall.
I agree. And I think all of these in some combination are probably a good option. The other thing too that I've really been struggling with over these past few days is a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing. I mean, we have to figure out what we're going to do, but in order to figure out what we're going to do, we need more information. And, you know, we don't have all of the information, but we need to start figuring out what we're going to do. And hopefully all of those pieces will kind of coalesce at the same time. So I think it makes sense to, you know, really explore all of these options as the situation evolves, but, you know, to have something in the works so that we can sort of play out different scenarios.
I would say to you that I know the Joint Fiscal Office is very aware of our situation, and I would say sympathetic. They are aware of the fact that you as a board have responded to previously challenging times, established a tax stabilization fund, been as fiscally responsible and forward-thinking as you can be, and that the position that you find yourselves in is of no, you know, it's not due to any decision making on your part. Kelly's probably on this call. Kelly Baia and I have had lots of conversations around this. I've spoken to other legislators, and people understand the situation, and I think that there would be, there's a likelihood of some level of response, but I do encourage you as a board to, you know, make a decision to take some action and over the next couple of weeks prior to the session opening.
Okay. And Randy and I have spoken about this. I've also spent a lot, I think Randy and I both spent a lot of time on the phone with different people talking about this. And I think, you know, a lot of people in the legislature are aware of Win Hall. And I would agree, like, just from what I've heard, that, you know, this is not poor budgeting. This is something that certainly couldn't have been anticipated when we passed our budget in March, and, you know, definitely not when we approved it as a board last January. So I think exploring any and all options to try to find some relief. I mean, it's one of those things where, objectively speaking, if you looked at someone and said, hey, we had, you know, 50 some odd kids move into the area after we passed our budget, because of the pandemic, I don't think anyone would think that it would be fair to, you know, pit us with the tax rate that would flow from that, particularly because if we weren't talking about the tax rate, I think you could hold Win Hall up as a success story. You know, we are attracting new families to the area. We're bringing, you know, new energy into the economy. I think, you know, we have many, many things to be proud of. I think this has the potential to be a very good story, but I think we need to get around the tax issue first.
If you have a backyard or a front yard, you can compost. It's really simple. You build or buy a compost bin to throw your compostable items into, which cover a wide range of leftover food items, coffee grinds, paper, dead leaves, and basically throw them into something that replicates and hastens the natural action of the forest floor. Ever wonder where all the leaves on trees from a couple of hundred years ago went? Chances are, you're walking on them. With landfill space getting tighter all the time, the incentives to compost are increasing. Instead of throwing out recyclable food and other items into the trash, you can buy or build your own compost bin, and over time, the decomposition of everything you put into it will yield some great fertilizer to mix in with your soil to grow your vegetables or flowers. The Bennington County Regional Commission wants to help. They are making some of the pails and bins and other accessories available. We caught up with Michael Batcher, their solid waste program manager, in East Dorset a couple of weeks ago, as he was helping distribute some of the tools of the trade.
Selling compost bins and little kitchen buckets called kitchen composters and pails that people can use to divert their food scraps from the landfill. So they can compost in their backyard with a kitchen composter, with the backyard soil saver composter. They can put stuff in the little bucket, this little kitchen bucket to bring out to the soil saver, or they can put things in this pail and bring it to the transfer station. So they have several options in order to divert their food scraps.
Intrigued, we reached out to Dan Stoll of Bennington, who had completed a course offered by UVM on becoming a master composter. Dan walked us through the steps.
I start with a big carbon sink. And a carbon sink basis means a big pile of leaves, which you'll see right here in front of you. I get my neighbors to give me all their leaves in the fall and kind of use that to make sure that things happen along. When you're composting, you need a good mix of carbon and nitrogen. And what we say with that is, carbon heavy material and nitrogen heavy material. So a lot of your kitchen scraps are gonna be nitrogen heavy material. And you need to balance those out with a lot of carbon heavy material. So leaves, sticks, wood shavings, shredded paper, napkins, those are all great carbon materials. And those are great to mix into your greens, your nitrogen heavy material, which would be, your apple cores, your cucumber peelings, any kind of kitchen scraps like that. I do collect a lot of stuff in our kitchen in a sealed container. We just keep it on the counter, or a lot of people keep them under the counter. I also divert some of my kitchen scraps to a vermicompost bin. I got that from Urban Worm Bags. I keep it in the basement. It has a nice population of red wiggler worms, and they do a good job of chewing that stuff down, turning it into worm castings, which are great in the garden as well as the regular compost. I divert a lot of that. I take the coffee grounds. I don't drink coffee, but my wife does. I take coffee grounds. These are extremely high in nitrogen, and these go just directly right onto to a pile. The vermin, the rats, the squirrels, they don't touch the coffee grounds, so we can go ahead and put that straight out there. The rest of our kitchen scraps, it's a kind of a light barrel this time. Got some avocado peel. We've got some carrot shavings. Got a pear core. These all go into a sealed container, which I can show you up here. I just keep that sealed to keep it away from the vermin and to keep them from getting into it. One thing that you want to do is you want to make sure that there is a lot of available oxygen to it. So I've taken this trash can, and I've drilled holes all throughout it to get oxygen to the stuff. And the idea is just to let it sit for a while until it doesn't become food anymore, until it doesn't become attractive to the vermin. Once it's no longer attractive to them, seal it back up here so we make sure that they don't get into it. Once it's no longer attractive to them, we'll take it down here. And I can show you. So I've got a couple working piles here. This pile right here has been going for since the spring. It got really hot in, I'd say about May April through May. You want your compost pile to get to about 140 degrees for a few weeks at a time. That really speeds up the decomposition process. It encourages thermophilic organisms, which are organisms that really break down the stuff really fast. And it's still a little hot right now. You can kind of reach in and feel a little bit. But the idea of placing it here is that it gets good sunlight throughout most of the day, but it's not absolutely hammered by it all day long. So it doesn't get too hot and it doesn't get too cold. It's also open. You want your compost pile to get a lot of moisture, so I rely on a lot of rain. I don't really rely on tap water to moisten my compost pile. If you do that, the chlorine in the tap water will kind of kill off some of those organisms that you want to break the stuff down. And when I'm talking about organisms, I'm talking about everything from earthworms. You definitely want earthworms in there. They grind it up and they turn into smaller stuff. You want fungi, beneficial fungi. You want nematodes. You want kind of all that stuff that naturally occurs on that kind of helps decompose something in nature. This, like I said, has been going on for a few months. I try to turn it about once a week or so. They really recommend turning it a little more often than that, but I work full time and yeah, I can get to it on the weekends. So you kind of got to let it work within your schedule.
If you're interested, registration for the 2020 Master Composter course is now open. It's an online course that will be given between September 11th and November 13th. To register, visit go.uvm.edu/VT Master Composter course and sign up. But composting need not be just an individual activity. If you run a business that generates a lot of compostable items, you can get into the game also. Andrea Lucchini, the horticulturalist and greenhouse manager at Hildene in Manchester, describes how those a level or two above your basic backyard gardener can also take advantage of the recyclable materials.
So the compost comes from a lot of different places on the property. It is a mix of the cuttings and weeds and deadheading from all the ornamental gardens, as well up by the house and around there, as well as the vegetable gardens down here at the Dean. It also is some of the manures from our animals, mostly down here at the Dean. We have 5 different types of animals, but also we have a goat dairy, so some of the manure from there gets incorporated into this, as well as food scraps. The main purpose for this structure was to incorporate food scraps from our catered events like weddings. So we mix all of those, those 3 sources. We mix them together in a recipe to make a really good compost. So the center of the compost, we have this big thermometer that goes in the middle. And we get temperatures up to, they have to be over 130 degrees in order to kill off bacteria and weed seeds and all that sort of thing. So we monitor that and turn it to make sure the outsides get to the inside, to that really hot part. We actively turn our piles at least for 6 months. They get turned once a week. It's better to do it more often, but time is limited. But for at least 6 months, and then for at least another 6 months, it cures. Means it sits and just sort of settles down. There's bacteria in there that are doing the composting and other microorganisms, and that those settle down so that it's not hot going on your garden. So after about a year, we expect to be able to use the compost we make out of these bins.
Wherever you are on the composting spectrum, with a little effort, you can create a win-win, fertilizer for free, and easing pressure on landfill capacity. Plus, it's kind of fun. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. North Shire voters streamed to the polls on Tuesday, August 11th, for Vermont's state primary election. While there was an enormous increase in the number of ballots mailed in or voters casting theirs as absentee ballots, due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, there was also a steady number of voters doing it the traditional way, in person, even if in some cases that meant staying in your car for drive-by voting. That was the case in Manchester, where voting was moved to the town's recreation park, and voters made three stops to complete a loop. Election official Cindy Kilburn explained.
And check in. Stop their vehicles right here. Remain in the vehicle. Give us your name. We check you in. Then you move ahead to pick up your ballots from the next stop. And you stay in your car to vote. And we have a ballot box on the far side where they deposit their ballots before exiting the parking lot. It's gone very smoothly. And it's worked well. The weather's very much cooperated. And we're hoping we're back indoors in November.
Town Clerk Anita Sheldon and Assistant Town Clerk Laura Strieber filled us in on how it was going.
Yesterday when we closed, we had about 960 absentee ballots returned to our office, which is a significant amount considering we usually have about 100 to 150 absentees and between 700 and 900 for primary election in total. So we'll put the Ender card through as soon as the last voter comes through, and then that's when we'll start looking for voter intent. And we'll look at every ballot as we usually do. That process has not changed through the Secretary of State's office, and we plan on doing the same thing that we usually do. Yeah. We are planning for some write-ins, but I have not heard of many write-in races, so it should be a reasonable night.
I've had a couple of people who have had to stop, and they've been really great at taking direction. If they have to pull in for a matter that's going to take a little bit longer than... They're very considerate on not holding other people up, and they're listening really well and working together to make this a success.
Meanwhile, up in Dorset, voting migrated from the Dorset School to the town offices in East Dorset, where voters could also vote from their vehicles, or on horseback, as one voter did, or on bicycle. Town Clerk Sandra Pincineau gave us her takeaway.
Okay, so they come in the west driveway, they give their name, they get given their ballots and a pencil, and then they pull in and they park, they vote their ballots, and then as they exit, they deposit their unvoted ballots in the blue box and their voted ballot in the voting machine box. Absolutely, yes, we have all of our absentees processed. We had over 400 absentees, and those are all processed already, and we've had another close to 100 people come through the drive-thru, so it's going well.
In Arlington, in-person voting was moved to the American Legion Hall, where voters entered on one side and left on the other. Jerry Woodard was there helping out and keeping all the voting booths sanitized.
The new Mr. Clean, the look of the new Mr. Clean. Here he is. We're here in Arlington, Vermont. No, it's ready for the next vote. Well, you step up here first, and then you give them your name to collect. Pick up your three ballots, Democrat, Republican, and Independent. Then you go into the booth, you fill out the one you want to fill out. When you're done with the booth, you put the ones that you don't want in the garbage, and you put the one that you voted with in the tabulator. Thank you. That's the way it works.
In terms of the outcome in local races, the most widely watched one was in the Democratic primary for the state representative district that includes Manchester, Arlington, Sandgate, and part of Sunderland, which featured a three-way race between incumbent Representative Kathleen James, Seth Bongartz, a former legislator who ran jointly with James, and newcomer Jamie Dufour. James and Bongartz emerged as the top two vote-getters in the primary and will go on to face the other incumbent state representative in the two-member district, Cynthia Browning, who will be seeking re-election to her seat as an independent. We had the chance to speak with both Representative James and Seth Bongartz the morning after the election.
I mean, I would like to think that the results in our race were in part due to the hard work that I've put in over in my first term. I've worked really hard over the past 2 years to reach out to all four of the communities I represent. I've spent a lot of time trying to connect with voters, especially, from the get-go. Spent a lot of time sending out emails, holding coffee hours, reaching out to constituents, proactively and also responding to constituents whenever they had a concern, worked very hard during the COVID crisis to help people with unemployment, to make sure businesses knew, businesses, schools, and communities knew about all the grants and assistance that was available to them. And so I feel that I've worked hard to be a good rep, and I hope in some part that the vote total reflects that. So that was, you know, that was, I guess, gratifying to see that. And I hope that the vote total also represents some confidence in the team that Seth and I would represent going forward. So I'm excited. I'm excited about the general election. I think we're going to have some really good conversations about the economy in the general election. And I think everybody knows that the most urgent issue going forward in November is how we're going to help families, communities, and our businesses recover from COVID. That's what it's all about. It's going to be about how we can help our region recover and then reinvent itself and come out even stronger from COVID. And it's also very importantly going to be about leadership and who's the most effective team and who are the most effective leaders.
It's the economy, it's recovery. And it's, you know, people, a lot of people are hurting through this. A lot of people have lost their jobs through no fault of their own. We have to make sure that they are, I'm not sure I really want to say taken care of, but I'll use that terminology. But you know, that's our responsibility to them. It's not their, it's not their fault. And then the small business sector is obviously having a really difficult time through this. And I think that in some ways, what we're presenting is nose to the grindstone work. You know, that's what legislators really do. It's nose to the grindstone work. And I think we're, the two of us are particularly well positioned just because of who we are and the way we think and our histories of really working closely with the communities here. And then not just taking those ideas to Montpelier, but working them back and forth. Really being involved, deeply involved here with the small business sector, with community leaders across the four towns, and then yes, taking those ideas to Montpelier and helping to do what we can to help the district, but really going back and forth and being an effective conduit.
Another race that had local residents was for the state auditor position, where Representative Linda Joy Sullivan, the current state representative from Dorset, Danby, Peru, Landgrove, and Mount Tabor, challenged the incumbent Democrat state auditor, Douglas Hoffer. Sullivan ran strongly in the local districts in Bennington County, but failed to capture a majority of votes statewide, losing to Hoffer by a 52% to 36% margin. Representative Sullivan will still be on the ballot in the November general election for state representative. The general consensus from talking with election officials was that mail-in voting went well, and the state should be in a good position to continue that in November, should the COVID-19 pandemic still be a large factor in determining if people feel that's a safer route, or one that's simply more convenient as well. Meanwhile, in the other statewide races, Governor Phil Scott won in the Republican primary, fending off challenger John Klar by a 72-22% margin. Scott Milne led the pack of Republicans seeking the party's nomination for lieutenant governor. On the Democratic side, Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman came out ahead of former Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. And in the widely watched lieutenant governor's race on the Democratic side, newcomer Molly Gray pulled off a victory over State Senator Tim Ash, the Senate pro tem leader, in what would have been considered a major surprise at the start of the election cycle. It sets up an interesting series of races up and down the ballot in November. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.